This is Cut to It with Steve Smith Sr., a production of The Black Effect and iHeartRadio. I'm Steve Smith Sr.
And I'm Gerard Littlejohn.
And this is Cut to It.
Cut to it. Cut to it. Let's get down to it. Cut to it.
We ask the questions you always want to know, but no one ever asks.
Let's cut to it.
I should know it's on.
You ain't heard about it, then we're about to let you know.
I should know it's on.
It's on.
Bounce off the wall.
Hit the stands. Nothing but net.
Calling you. Oh, that's old school right there.
Yeah.
What's on your mental?
What's on my mental? So I did this fantastic. So I'm not bragging, but I am going, as you listen to this podcast, you will find out. I will let you into my life. Mm-hmm. And so I have a Peloton treadmill.
Ooh.
Okay. Love the Peloton treadmill. Huh?
They paying us?
No, they're not paying us, but I'm just telling you I like the treadmill. And hopefully if I continue to explore how the treadmill is intertwining itself with my life, maybe something will come out of it.
There you go.
If not, I will be in Peloton.
Brought to you by.
I will be in studio at some point, though. I already have linked up with them somehow, some way, in getting into the Peloton studio in New York.
There you go.
Woo!
There you go.
So... I'm starting to become an avid runner. Mm. So I was running the other day, and there is this thing, it's a heart rate zone. And this heart rate zone was a power run, and it was 45 minutes. And so I'm going in this heart rate, and so I know my heart rate and all that stuff, and I was in a zone 3, upper 4, and we're probably about 10 minutes left of this 45-minute run. And we have probably 5 minutes of run, 3 minutes of short burst, and then a 2-minute cool down. Okay. So that's 10 minutes. So we hit the regular 5 minutes, bang, go. The last 2 minutes, let me tell you something. These last 2 minutes, this machine is really showing me that it is not just a machine that just sits up in the room. It is a machine that it's giving me a perspective of life that I never knew.
Okay, so this ain't just a two-wheeled coat rack.
Nah, this
You're
ain't.
You using it?
Yeah, I'm using it.
Okay.
Like, so here's how I use it. I got in mid-September. I ran about 20 miles.
Okay.
October, built up to 42 miles. November, 52 miles.
Look at you.
Right?
Slim and trim.
I'm enjoying the space. But on this treadmill, it has a big old screen. And then it has two buttons. One button is a stop. And then that stop in the middle says stop. On the right, it says sleep. On the other part of the stop, it says wake. That's just to get it going. Mm-hmm. Then there's this button that I have not known. I've had it since September. I have not known what this button is for. But I damn sure found out this weekend.
So you had a moment of discovery.
No, I didn't have a moment of discovery. I had a crash and burn.
Oh no. Do tell.
On this button, you know what the word is? Free.
Okay.
And what's free? Please ask me what free is.
What's free?
Free is free
like
mode.
A meal track.
Yes. My mind was going there too. But guess what? What's free in this one. Bro, free is when the treadmill comes to a complete stop and you now have to make the treadmill move
on its
own.
Oh, yeah.
You know
Ooh,
what? I got off that treadmill, and these are my words directly off the treadmill. I don't want nothing else for free. No more. I kind of joke around and say, hey, you know, you can always get a free butt whooping. But I'm telling you, that is
that's something you did not want to receive.
I want no more no free parts. Shit. I don't want any more free stuff. It
Cease
killed
and
me.
Desist.
Yes. Hey, would you like a free? No, 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 no.
I'm free.
I have post-traumatic stress. If you say free, I just flinch, bro. It was so crazy.
Yeah.
In this free mode is basically you go to a complete stop. Mm-hmm. Then you run holding the bar? Mm. And you make it go. And she proceeded to tell us
by your own strength.
Yes, at what speed we're supposed to go.
Yeah, this is like your old school training, like you in the league.
Yeah,
you ain't want that.
I don't want that. I don't want a free exercise like that. That is that's make money workout.
It's different levels to it.
Man, I got off that treadmill. I looked at that treadmill and I flinched at it like
the way it was going, it might have jumped in, slapped the hell out of you.
But it was such an awesome moment because this treadmill is really, I'm starting to discover and figure out in this world of running, mm-hmm. what a recovery run is, what a endurance run is I am learning how to exercise without the money carrot being dangled. This is more of a health. This is a lifestyle for me. And I'm extreme workout guy. So when I say extreme, like I've been able to lose 5 or 6 pounds in a week, right? I'll starve myself. Then I become hangry because I'm hungry and angry, right? I've been on crash diet. I've done all of this stuff. But this time has really been pretty cool to see how do I slowly just create good habits. And I'm telling you, that free mode, it made me question myself.
No more free.
I don't. If someone would have walked up to the door, rang the doorbell, said, "Hey, I got a free dozen of donuts," bam, right in the face.
Donations.
I don't want any. It was crazy. But so think about it. In 3 months. So my question is, for the listeners right now, take this moment. What things in your life, or person, or household item has been there for years, but you've never really known it's there? You've never really pushed that free button to discover, what does this really mean?
Look at you dropping knowledge. I'm about to take you on the motivational speaking tour.
Hey, I ain't free. Hey, who we got next?
Coming up on the Cut to It podcast, we've got Chastity Melvin, an assistant coach with the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury, a star at North Carolina State, and the author of At the End of the Day. Chastity Melvin on the Cut to It podcast. Chastity, thanks for coming on the Cut to It podcast. Hope you're doing all right.
I'm doing great. You know, can't complain. I got back to basketball, was able to coach, so I'm okay.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Hey, coming up, we have our own version of our icebreaker. It's called Get Iced Up. So they're going to be random questions. Okay. You have no idea what's coming. Steve may or may not have a follow-up. You just don't know, right? So I'm going to let Steve go ahead and fire off the first question to you.
You ready?
I was born ready. Let's go.
Ooh, born ready. Let's go.
Well, since you were born ready, what's the strangest thing you've ever eaten then?
Octopus.
That ain't that strange.
That ain't strange. Yeah. Charred?
Right.
No, it was baked.
Okay. Look at you. Oh, uppity. It was baked.
Uppity octopus eater.
How many states have you been to?
At least 25. Probably okay. More. Yeah.
All right. Tell me a random one that just, like, why were you there?
Wisconsin.
Yeah, I can get that.
Why do you think Wisconsin's weird?
I've been to Wisconsin.
I know.
Yeah. It's Wisconsin is like...
outside of cheeseheads.
Yeah, Wisconsin is one of those places, if you've never been and then you go, it's like when you walk into a store and you realize, whoops.
Steve, you couldn't have explained it any better.
She knew exactly what you're talking about.
You know, I'm coming in, I went to a pizza joint, I just sat down, and then I sat there for a while and everyone was staring at me, and then I looked around like, oh,
we know why they're staring. I went there, me and my son went there. The Dodgers were playing the Brewers, so we went out there and went to a Dodgers game. Unbelievable stadium. It was remarkable. Then we also went, my son was like, "Hey Dad, let's go to the mall, you know, to get a souvenir or something." Mm-hmm. All right. Same thing like that pizza joint. We walked in the mall. I don't really call it a mall. So, but it was cool. Okay. When did you first feel like an adult?
when I first got my first check as a pro and I saw the taxes taken out of it.
Mm. Oh, that's the that is the humbling part of it. Mm. I got a check. Dang, who is what's FICA?
I actually called my mother and said,
I did the same thing.
Yeah, I was like, Mom, there's something wrong with my check. She was like, what do you mean?
FICA and why I gotta give her money?
Yep. She said, Welcome to the grown world, honey. Welcome to the real world.
All right, last one. What's your dream job?
Dream job thing or something. My dream job would probably be traveling all over the world, just having camps and clinics and someone else paying for everything and first class travel. That's my dream job.
Oh, so you want to be a rich kid then, huh?
I don't necessarily have to have the money, but someone can, you know, fund me, you know, fund my travel, fund all the expenses. I'm not asking for much, Steve. That's not asking a lot.
No, it's not. Yeah, I just want to travel around the world. No responsibility. Someone else pay.
Dreamers can dream.
Yeah. Pretty much.
I get it. All right, let's get right into it. We really appreciate you coming on. And we really just want to know, who is Chastity Melvin? Like, why, what, when, where? So we have some staples that we always go to, and I always love asking this question because the response that we usually get is always well received. So where are you from and the place you call your hometown?
So my home, I'm from humble beginnings in Roseboro, North Carolina. Obviously, it's a small town right southeast of Fayetteville. So Vietnam, as they call it, or whatever, Fort Bragg area. Basically, there, you know, my town wasn't even really 1,200 people. My graduating class was, I had 98 kids in my senior class when I graduated from high school.
I can relate.
Yeah, just a very small town. And I came up playing basketball on the dirt roads, and, you know, here I am. So that's the brief story.
What's humble beginnings mean? Because
it means different for everybody.
It means different for everybody. I'm from the city. You know, I'm from the inner city of L.A. So humble beginnings is a lot different. From someone in Lexington, like G. G's from Lexington, North Carolina.
Yeah, I got backup with me today. Careful.
Yeah. So my humble, yeah, you know what, Steve? I've actually, throughout my travels, and obviously when I went to college, I learned my humble beginnings were a lot different from some of my teammates that grew up in Jersey and Newark and different places. Obviously, I was raised by a village, so, you know, I felt a lot of love and I always had food to eat. So it wasn't anything as a big a sacrifice as that. But I mean, basically growing up, I guess for us growing up in a single wide, I had two sisters, two brothers, with my mom and dad in a single wide trailer, just kind of like sleeping together on top of each other pretty much. And my dad and my mom didn't go to school, but my dad was a minister. So our foundation was based on, you know, it was just our faith. And my dad, you know, was just drove a station wagon, drove us all around. So we got made fun of a lot growing up. But, you know, when the welfare, when they had extra food to come, like my mom would send me out to get the welfare cheese and the extra food that, you know, they passed out in Sampson County. So it was really humble beginnings. Grew up working on a farm with my grandmother, cropping tobacco. And I knew very early on, I told my grandmother I was going to be doing this when I grew up. So I knew there was going to be a better life for me somewhere.
How did she take that response, your grandmother, when you said?
No, she was she said, well, as long as you work hard and get your education, you can do what she believed in me from day one. And she just told me to give everything to God and give my desires to God. And so she was very instrumental because growing up in the country, as a Southern girl, I wasn't really supposed to be playing with the boys. And so I had to fight to get on the basketball courts, out on the dirt courts. And I remember they wouldn't let me play. So I went and told my grandmother. She was kind of the matriarch of the family. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, she came out to the court with me. She was holding my hand and I was scared. I was like, oh gosh, I got everybody in trouble.
Where this is going?
What was grandma's name?
Her name was Dixie.
Miss Dixie.
Her name was Dixie, but everyone called her mother. Everyone called her mother in the town. So I walked over there and she was like, and the guys stopped because they saw her walking. And she said, okay, boy. She was like, do we all eat together? And they said, yes, ma'am. And they was like, well, if Chastity doesn't play, you guys won't be eating today. So I was on the court from then on.
Well, it was feeding her too.
Yeah.
Dimes all of a sudden.
Miss Dick, did Miss Dixie, did she have house shoes on most of the time?
No, but she always wore a dress.
Okay.
She always wore, yeah, she always wore a dress. She never wore pants. So we struggled with that a little bit. I remember coming home from church. I had gone overseas. I thought I was growing up. I was an adult. And I came to the church with a pantsuit on. And I'll never forget, she and all her other friends at the church thought lightning was going to strike. Like, they couldn't believe I walked in church with a pantsuit.
That's the old school Holiness church.
Ms. Dixie sounds like, though, the reason I asked, she sounded like she wore house shoes. Like, she always needed to be ready in case something dropped. It went down.
Got that house coat that's missing the tie around, so mm-hmm. she got to hold it like, you know, button yep. together with the fingers, pinch together with the fingers.
Yeah. Don't make me. Don't let
no,
me.
No, for sure. Dixie.
Oh, she ain't got to say it. She's look at you.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. She had a rope. My mom's mom was the one that had house shoes and was ready to go. She was my real life Madea, my mom's mom. And her name was Jibo. People call her Jibo. Her name was Geneva.
Jibo. Shiggy.
Yeah. So.
He was house shoe too.
Yeah. Jibo was. Yeah. You didn't mess with Jibo at all.
So are you from a generation of. Are you from the timeout generation or the go get your switch generation?
No, I'm from the go get the switch generation. Yes, very much so.
And you got to pick the right one.
I got to pick the right one. And if my mom and dad weren't available to get, you know, make me go get a switch, then my grandparents or my aunt and uncle, like I was raised by a village. So everyone had, you know, equal rights to giving you a butt whooping.
What experiences did you have growing up there? I mean, outside of, you know, what you've just explained to us, that and how did those experiences really shape you and impact you to see the world today?
Basically, most of my experiences are, you know, I guess I like Madea because she reminds me of my grandmother's, but just the faith-based, being in church all the time. That was my foundation. So my dad was a minister. So I was basically in church Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We were just joking when I was at home. We would come home and everyone's on our basketball court when we would come home from church. And we'd have to wait, you know, 3 or 4 games to get in on our own court. So just that foundation has carried me, I think. It's just given me a sense of peace. Always, obviously, always hope. You know, always having hope and a bigger understanding that. You know, the world was a bigger place and I could obtain pretty much anything I wanted with my faith and my work ethic. Growing up under my grandmother's, they always woke us up early, the crack of dawn. They thought we were lazy if we slept past 6 o'clock. Mm. So, you know, they would come get us up over the summer and work in the field. So that's kind of where I learned about hard work. And I always also learned how you have to work smarter to really make the most money. So they taught me, they gave me a lot of wisdom early on. But just coming from a big family, whether it was playing outside with my cousins, basketball, or riding dirt bikes or whatever, just to learn how to play, how to be a team player. And I learned a lot about loyalty and being good to people is always going to come back. So that's pretty much it.
Walk us through the process as a young chastity. Picking tobacco. And the reason I ask is, we're here, we're based here in Charlotte, North Carolina. I live in between Charlotte / Rock Hill. So I'm in between North and South Carolina.
It's kind of outskirts.
On the outskirts. And there are some back roads. If you could hit a left or hit a right, the first time I've ever seen cotton outside of
a t-shirt?
Of a package, a cotton ball or a swab or some of that has been, you know, in the spring, in the winter or whatever, when wind's blowing. And I'm like, what is this white stuff? Right? So knowing that that's cotton and seeing that. So I've experienced a lot of different things here living in North Carolina that I never experienced back home. Mm. And so you give me that opportunity of, you know, you've born here in the South and then such a young girl getting woken up and your family faith-based telling you and teaching you about hard work.
You know, yeah, it was terrible. I'm not going to lie. My younger sister always struggled because she never quite got out to the fields on time. She's still late to this day. So I don't know if she learned much from that. But
a moment.
No, it's just for me, you know, it just gave me a sense of what our ancestors went through. I mean, it was very backbreaking work. I hated the flies, the farmer's tan, and just getting your hands dirty with the, you know, getting all the green from the tobaccos, the tobacco worms. I was afraid of the worms, so my cousins thought that was cool to chase me around with tobacco worms. You know, we picked cucumbers. I was joking with someone yesterday, like, we made Kate's Pickles in Mount Olive Ridge because we used to pick cucumbers, and then, you know, that was, like, the end of the day, we get on the back of the pickup with my uncles and take all the cucumbers over there and distribute them to Kate's Pickles, and that's how my grandmother got paid. So you're like, dang, all this hard work and this is all we get? And as young as the kids, we never saw money. Our reward was like Nabs and a Coke, or a piece of candy from the store and a Coke. That's how we got paid.
You ain't getting paid. You're getting paid through the labor.
Yeah.
Watered with food.
So from an early age, I was like, there's got to be more. This can't be life.
We have to take a break, and more than anything, we got to pay some bills.
Mm-hmm. Need that check.
I love Cut To It, and I love it even more when you download us and subscribe.
And you can follow us on social media too, Smitty.
Where at?
That's at Cut To It on Instagram.
What about Twitter?
At Cut To It.
Facebook?
Cut To It featuring Steve Smith Sr.
What about online?
And you can follow us at cuttoitpodcast.com, where you can buy merch and you can subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts.
I got all my answers I got all my questions answered.
That's what I'm here for, brother. cuttoitpodcast.com. You've told us a lot about kind of and painting the picture of what it's like in rural North Carolina. Outside of basketball, what other sports did you play? And you've mentioned playing boys versus girls. How did that impact your life, playing with the boys, playing basketball so early? And what other sports were you playing?
I played every sport. I played everything that we had at our high school. In middle school, I played volleyball, basketball, softball, and I ran track. Just being able to play with the boys obviously made me the player I am today. Obviously prepared me to be a professional athlete because I had to be able to handle the basketball. I had to be able to have a quick release on my shot, or I wasn't able to stay on the court. You know, guys are a lot faster, stronger. They blocked my shot a lot when I first started playing. So I had to really develop my game just to be out there with the boys and be able to be successful. So I know that's what helped me become not only a great college athlete, but a great pro.
At what moment did you start to think about playing basketball beyond high school or starting to play AAU? When did you take that serious?
I started taking it serious pretty much in the fifth grade. There was another one of my classmates that was taller than me, and he was a guy, and he played football. And we kind of just made a pact. He said he was going to be a professional football player, and I said I was going to be a professional basketball player, even though there weren't professional basketball teams at the time. But I just made that my goal. And I fell into love with the game the moment I scored my first basket. So I went home and told my mother that's what I was going to do. So I've just been pretty focused. I don't know if it was just because I was young, country, you know, naive girl, but that was my story, and I was sticking to it. So
what was your mom's response when you said you wanted to play basketball for a living?
She just said, they don't have professional teams here, baby. And I said, well, they will when I grow up. Mm. And that was pretty much it. That was the end of the conversation. So,
because of you or mom? Like, who walked away first?
I did. I said, well, they will when I grow up. And I walked away. That was it. That was the end of the conversation. So,
eight ball corner pocket.
Yeah. You're growing up, you're in high school, you're knee deep in basketball now.
Yeah.
Men and women's basketball in North Carolina has always been a big deal, mm-hmm. right? It's always, you know, it's inspiring, and then it's the gift. You know, how was it for you as your love for basketball grew? How was watching basketball and seeing basketball, how it was portrayed here in North Carolina, men and women? Like, men and women basketball back in the day, you had, what, Tennessee, North Carolina. Like, it was some, especially the women, mm-hmm. it was some ballers back then.
Yeah, for sure. I'll never forget, in Fayetteville, North Carolina, they hosted the ACC tournament, and my uncle told my mom she needed to take me. And so we went to that ACC tournament, and I think that was the changing point as far as mentally and just really realizing that I could achieve my dream. And I'll never forget, it was Carolina and NC State in the championship game. And afterwards, I was able to get some autographs from the NC State players. And I told my mom, I'm like, okay, I can do it. Like driving back home, I was like, that just made it a reality. So I'm a firm believer in, like, I know it's cliche, but people say you got to see it, you know, see it, believe it, and achieve it. And once I was able to see that there were so many other females like me that really loved the game, that just kind of solidified my dream and the fact that I could achieve it. And I grew up with my dad and my brothers watching the NBA. So I'm very old school NBA. We were a Lakers family. My dad, my brother loved Magic Johnson. So I never really got to see female pro athletes, but I still held on to my dream. And so for me, I mean, I still have I'm very fond of the NBA because I took a lot of my moves from like Karl Malone and Chris Webber and Tim Duncan inside the post. Like, I would steal moves from the post players, like watching the NBA games. And that helped shape me as a professional athlete as well.
So stealing the moves.
Yeah.
Watching the Lakers. So yeah. You obviously, with your upbringing, AC Green, he was known for being a virgin. So did you mimic his Jerry curl too?
No, I did mimic his Jerry curl, but I did pledge that I was going to be a virgin until I got married. Yeah. So I did. I mean, I was, and he was, you know, obviously he did that because of his faith.
Yes.
So that was big for me as well. So I kind of admired that, like, wow, this. And then obviously you always heard the guys talking about, he lying, man, he lying. So, you know, I was caught in between, like, is it a lie or is he really that steadfast? This is Cut to a Podcast. I'm just going to cut right to it. I had the Jerry curl.
How many times a day did you spritz your Jerry curl? Like, was it?
You know what? Guys, I got made fun of a lot because I hated the spritz and the juice stuff. So it was a dry ass Jerry curl.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was terrible.
You didn't want to have the juice and berries.
No, I didn't want to have the juice and berries.
You had the dry split in jokes.
That ain't nothing
I was sweating a lot playing, and I was like, this is way too much. I think that scarred me for life. But yeah, my middle school years with the Jerry curl my middle school years were terrible. On up until my 10th grade year. So I was really like, what's the rapper? Like, back then they didn't want me, now it's hot. That was my whole story. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I had to throw it. Just quite thought. Curl all the way over because it was.
Yeah, it wouldn't quite curl over. Yeah. Right there.
Girl. A curl. Very that curl. Wrong. All right, so we moving on. Let's skip over to Jerry curl so we don't slip and fall. And let's get up into your career. Right, so doing all the research and some of that stuff, and I went in there and I just saw some things that I just needed clarification on.
Okay.
It says that you played in the ABL League. What is the ABL League?
So the ABL was American Basketball League, and it was the first professional league for women. So a lot of people don't talk about it in the history of the women's game because it was kind of like just – I don't know. There was a rift between the ABL and the WNBA because ABL felt like they folded because the WNBA took all the market sponsorships and all that stuff. And that's why the league folded. So they were actually played year round in the States before the WNBA was created. And I chose the ABL out of college because I wanted to play year round and I wanted to stay in the States pretty much.
So. How different. When you look back, how different was the ABL compared to the WNBA?
Well, I just thought personally for me, and I think a lot of the players, like we, our slogan was real basketball. And we played with the men's basketball. We played during the regular basketball season along with aside the NBA and college. We had fans. It wasn't like a jam-packed season. It was just, you know, just real basketball. Like we played like, you know, everyone else. And so for us, we just found pride in that. And it had the best basketball players. And there were a lot more teams than the WNBA. I think we had at least, if I'm not mistaken, we had at least 22, 23 teams. And it was just great basketball. And the players were passionate about it because it was the first league. But unfortunately, just couldn't get the sponsorships, couldn't get TV time. And it folded my rookie season. It folded at Christmas. And that was a really traumatic experience for me a little bit, just, you know, learning you reach your dream and then it's kind of like taken away. You're just blindsided by, like, you know, you get the call from the GM, like, we no longer have a league, we no longer have a team, and you no longer have a paycheck. And, you know, it's just, it was a tough situation.
Professionally, you played all around the world.
Yes.
So where are some of the places you've played? And also, by playing there, you lived there. You know, what, so just take us through that first, you know, where around the world, where did you play? You know, did you stay there after the season? Just kind of walk us through that, because a lot of people don't know, maybe they do. There's a lot of European basketball, not just in men's, but also in women as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. I love playing overseas. Once the ABL folded, I got the opportunity to go to Spain, and that's where I played my first year in Northern Spain, in a city called Vigo. And then I was fortunately drafted by the WNBA after that season. So that summer I got drafted by the WNBA. And then from then on, it was WNBA in the summer and overseas in the fall. So I played in Israel, Turkey, Spain, Korea, China, Italy. Yeah, I played in Italy. I played in Russia. And I had a wonderful time. My favorite country is Israel. I played there for the most part, 5 years off and on in Israel. So I have family there, my adoptive Israeli family. So I was looking forward to going back this year because of COVID, it hasn't happened, but Israel is by far my favorite country. But I enjoyed Turkey, I enjoyed Italy. I enjoyed every country because for me, a lot of people made fun of me, but I mean, I was from a small town and growing up, our biggest dream outside just playing was like, okay, if we can get to New York City, you know, we felt like we made it. So for me to be able to travel to a different country and not only play basketball, but live and experience the culture, I took full advantage of it. So I enjoyed pretty much every country except Russia. Russia was a lot. It was too cold and there was no sunshine. So that was hard.
What's the difference in competition between overseas and then basketball domestically here, WNBA? You see a lot of players like one you coach, Diana Taurasi. What is the difference in that competition, if there is any?
Well, I mean, obviously we have the best players. You can obviously tell that from USA Basketball. But there are a lot of talented players in Europe. The basketball is great. For me personally, and I think every player from America, when you go over there, you are the catalyst for that team making it to the championship. So for me and like Diana Taurasi's and different players that go overseas and the same for the guys, you have all the pressure. Like you can't have bad games. You got to just make it happen game in and game out. So it's a lot of pressure. So it's basically like, it's my team going against, if I'm playing against Diana Taurasi's team. So which American is basically going to play the best and develop and make their other teammates look the best. But obviously the European players can play. They're very great offensively. But as far as physically and defensively, you know, they're still a little bit behind as compared to us. But I think that's evolving and that's changing now because so many of the players are coming to the WNBA or they're coming to play here in college. So they're learning the more physical side of the game and defensively. But they're well-oiled machines offensively overseas.
So basically y'all go over there and y'all be dragging them.
Back in the day, I would say, I would say, yeah, you know, just because we're just mentally tougher. I think it just takes time. As you see now with Luka coming over here, like these younger kids are playing, they're playing more physical and also able to score and do different moves that the game's evolved and changed. And obviously we've had some players in the WNBA that have come from overseas. Like one of the Brazilian kids killed us in the semifinals, Dantas, for Minnesota Lynx from Brazil. She dominated us, you know. So back in the day, that would have been kind of hard to really do for a kid coming from overseas. So now that's changing. So either the Americans got to really step their game up, or maybe it's just that's the way the game evolves.
What did you discover about yourself in those places? Because you obviously are going to those places. You have no family. You talked about Israel, right, and your adopted family, but you're in Russia, you're in Spain. You are not Roseboro, North Carolina. You ain't no Italians up in Roseboro, Carolina, picking cucumbers.
No, right. I think that's where my box became more open. I was more so closed-minded because NC State wasn't that different from my rural town. A lot of, I mean, it was Raleigh, but it was still North Carolina. It's still Southern, the Southern mentality, the kind of the same ideal. So once I started going overseas, it just really opened my mind, and I couldn't be as closed-minded as I was before. But as a person and as a female, for me, it just really built my confidence as an African-American woman. Like I said, I think here in the States, and obviously you guys wouldn't really experience this, but being a Black female wasn't always beautiful, especially in our natural state. So once I started going overseas to Spain and Italy, I will say, like, they thought Cassie was beautiful. So I enjoyed that.
She loves shooting us the truth. Like, you know what? I was down with the swirl over there.
I don't know what be a Black female.
Yeah. I mean, and a lot of people say, well, Chas, that's because you were a basketball player. But I got engulfed in the culture. And I think for overseas, there aren't that many Black Americans there per se in general. So for them to experience me in their culture and to, you know, just learn to appreciate and value, like, opposite of whatever they've seen on television. Because literally, I mean, the Americans that are over there are pretty much the only Black people there that they see. So, you know, they want to touch your hair. They want to, like, they're watching everything you do. And they're just appreciative of it. And then when they realize, hey, you know, you don't act like what we see on television, it just showed me, it just, you know, really opened my mind. And I was like, wow, like, you know, the stereotypes of us and how it's all the, you know, it goes all the way overseas, and people look at us a certain way and we're totally opposites. So for me, that was kind of mind boggling.
So how would that make you feel, and how would you navigate through it?
No, I just kept being myself. I mean, at the end of the day, I kept being myself. And I think they gained a greater appreciation. I think they gained a greater appreciation for other Americans inviting them over. And now it's like you can have two or three Americans on a team. And so most of the clubs and organizations really follow that pattern and enjoyed making their teams more diverse. So I think it's a great experience for anyone that could go overseas and kind of get intertwined with the culture, and they'll learn a lot about themselves. But I didn't speak the languages, and just learning that there are so many different things that are just understood whether you speak the language or not, like general manners and having a certain sense of respect for the elders and the young people. Like that's how the young people treat the older people. It's across the board. So for me, I just learned basketball spoke all languages, and it's really bigger than race and gender.
I think it's about that time. Just take a little breather.
Good, do it. Good, do it. Let's get down to it. Good, do it.
Hey, Gerard, where did you get that t-shirt?
You mean this thing?
Oh, yes.
I got it from CutToItPodcast.com, where we have exclusive merchandise. Shout out to our guys at 704 Shop. But yeah, you can go on, buy you a t-shirt, subscribe to us wherever you listen to podcasts.
This whole thing? let's talk ball. And when in talking ball, just really giving you an opportunity to just talk ball and talk shop with us. And again, like I said, I really don't know basketball that well.
You give yourself some more credit. You know basketball more.
I don't know it to the way I wish I knew it. I'm always impressed.
Yeah, I get that.
And impressed with how people talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask you, why has the analytics become a focal point of basketball and other sports so much?
Well, I just think it provides jobs for people who can't really get into coaching or can't, who haven't played or aren't as successful on the court in player development. I think it's great because I think it does provide, you know, I think it's an asset to coaches and teams. And obviously it provides some other jobs for people to be a part of an NBA organization or, I mean, even college. I think it's become the focal point because people, you know, as in all professional sports, someone wants to have an edge. Someone wants to know something different than maybe another organization has. And so that's kind of having a leg up if they can go by the analytics and make it work for their team. For me, I'm not against analytics, but I do feel like some things can't be measured. And I think that's why.
That's that old school coming out right there.
Yeah, I am super old school. Yeah, I'm super old school, but I've learned it from coaching. I mean, you look at the Miami Heat now, Jimmy Butler's still shooting, the mid-range. He still has the mid-range game. They're still getting old-fashioned and ones. And that's what I used to tell people all the time. Like, I'm okay with the three-point shot, but it baffles me why you drive all the way to the basket and then you kick it out. And then a guy misses a three when you could have still got an old-fashioned three-point play.
Yeah.
So as far as analytics, you can still get 3 points, you know, the old-fashioned way. So for me, I have my little qualms with it. But at the end of the day, it does help in certain aspects. As I mean, Charles Barkley wouldn't say this, but it does help is like if you're in a regular season and they can pretty much calculate, okay, the Lakers have been on the road for 5 games. When they come home and whoever travels there, the percentages of these guys shooting a bad percentage, or basically they can calculate, you know, how the game's going to go. Mm-hmm. For former players, we already know. I mean, when we travel, how it's going to be. We already know those teams coming into Atlanta are probably going to have an off night, but reasons that most of the analytics people won't know why those guys don't always play well in Atlanta.
Because of the wings.
You know what I mean? So at the end of the day, you know, players are pretty much like looking at analytics like, okay, that's not rocket science, like, because we just know. Or Isaiah Thomas, for instance, like, you know, he lost his sister, I believe it was, or, you know, we have deaths in the family. Like, it's not rocket science. You're going to get lit up by that dude the next game if he decides to play or that female. Like, you can't measure the heart. You can't measure just the focus that a player is going to have. But obviously, it does have its credibility as far as overall giving you a picture of like a 82-game season and just the different highs and lows of a team. So there's some good things with it, but at the end of the day, there are some things that I believe are immeasurable.
What was the draft process for a WNBA player? Because, you know, obviously with everything going on and television, we see the documentaries, but the WNBA does not have – they haven't – had that access displayed on the television like you've seen in other documentaries of higher picks. Okay. So, you know, walk us through that process, even for yourself and for other players that we don't get to see, because sometimes we see it and we just see what the camera shows, which is the glitz and glamour. But there's a lot of things that go on behind the scenes that we have no idea about.
Yeah, there's so many untold stories of the WNBA, and they're great stories. But because of the short amount of coverage we get and just the fact that I don't know if it's networks or just individuals don't want to put a camera on that or don't think it's significant enough. But there are so many different factors affecting female athletes, and more so just off the court, just as a female athlete, a female in general, trying to join professional sports and just kind of male-dominated arenas. So for the fortitude a player, a female athlete has to have just to overcome stereotypes and the different challenges that come with wanting to be a professional ball player, not only from, you know, just those in their circle and their culture. I mean, Black males, Black females, like you have a lot of Black females that are like looking at Black female athletes like, what the hell are you doing? You know, or like putting certain negative stereotypes on us, on the way we look, the way our bodies are, and you know, everything that comes along with that, whether they're straight, gay, whether they're whatever their political activists, whatever they go for, like there's, we're always being criticized. So I think it would be great to get the behind scenes stories of a player getting drafted and everything they've gone through through their college career, all from their high school career to become a pro. But it's challenging. And I hope that, I just told someone, being in the wobble was an eye opener for me because of everything that's going on in the world with racism and just poor leadership, police brutality, everything that's going on. Like, we were in the wobble. We have the male WNBA coaches. We have the female WNBA coaches. We have Black, white. We have Australian, different nationalities in the wobble. We have players from overseas, like I said. Then we have, you know, your mama, your mothers were there with their baby daddies. Then we had wives there with their husband and their kids. Then we had the same sex relationships. We had people voicing, using their voice for activism. And then we had people from the league office that were also in the wobble. So for me, I said, wow, this is the US. This is as diverse as you can get, you know? And for me, just the total respect and admiration that everyone had for each other was beautiful. And if the world could be like that, it would be an awesome place to be. So for us to get to experience each other on and off the court and see the different dynamics day in and day out, because we all were in that wobble together at the hotel, at the lodges, at the pool, eating dinner together. It was a beautiful thing. So I hope ESPN or someone was there with cameras to kind of get that, and hopefully they can make a documentary of it, because it is, I think it would, you know, opens up people's eyes a lot to different type of women we have in the league. Not women also, but just the men. We had great men coaches there as well that were very supportive.
I love your illustration and your analogy of how everything was essentially under one roof when it came to the bubble or the wobble. How did you protect your mental psyche while you're in that bubble?
They had resources for us, but I think it was just having that camaraderie and being able to talk to each other, giving our players just still giving them a day to themselves. Whether they just wanted to hang out by themselves, because, you know, obviously you're seeing the same people every day. That can be overwhelming too. And not just kind of having to put on when you were kind of like just down or feeling like, I got to get out of this bubble. You know, like some nights I'd be like, I just got to drive somewhere. It's like, you can't do it. But there were a lot of sponsors. People did different things virtually with the players. So they had a lot of things online. A lot of people were sending them free gifts and free makeup, free hair products. So the females were spoiled a little bit. We were spoiled a little bit. Well, I won't say we, because the coaches didn't get it. But the players got a lot of great. I would sneak down there and be like, I was a former player. But they got a lot of great gifts to, you know, kind of make their day, you know, by surprise. And then once the game started, it just kind of started flying by once the game started. So I think mentally everyone was just made it through. But there were a lot of resources for them to have people to talk to.
All right. Well, Chastity, our last segment is called the Deep Three. And these are just three questions that we ask to go beyond the jersey, to go beyond the court. And so what we're going to do is go ahead and set this up for you. Samita's going to give you the first question, but it's really to just take this to a deeper level and get a better understanding of Chastity.
Okay.
Well, Chastity, you talked about your faith. You talked about Grandma Dixon and how what she was and how your dad and your mom, how you were raised faith-based. When was it a time in your life where your faith was tested?
The first time my faith was tested, I believe, is when I encountered a relationship with that of the same sex. And up until that point, I had never engaged in that. And once I told my friends about it, never forget, I actually called my ex-boyfriend at the time and I told him what happened. He was like, "You're going to go to hell." He was so judgmental. I can laugh about it now, but it really hurt my feelings. Just being raised in the church and how people started reacting to my parents and to me per se, it was just, I get where people say Christianity is so judgmental. People are so judgmental. And the fact that everything I had did up there and the fact that my personal relationship is my personal relationship just kind of went out the door. And it was just like, "You're going to hell. What are you doing?" So for me, my faith was tested. And I had a huge battle, you know, as far as everything that I thought I knew about God and I thought I knew about my faith was just like, "I don't want this. If this is what my faith is about, I don't want it." But obviously, it also made me closer to God and it made me learn just how much God's love for me is so real. And ever since then, it's been on and popping DJ Rocket. You know, Jesus rocks, and I am forever God's child, and I'm always promoting my faith. And I want to help others that are challenged in any realm of their Christian walk. Like I look at some of the rappers now, Chance the Rapper and Lecrae, and how the church did them and how they still, you know, spread their music regardless, you know, what people think about it. Because it's all about a personal relationship. And so my faith was truly tested. I disengaged from the church. I had a rift with my family, but at the end of the day, it made me stronger and it made my faith stronger.
Now, you said it hurt your feelings.
Yeah.
What, obviously outside of them saying you're going to hell, what particular, if it's okay for me to ask, what particular thing or singular or multiple things that they do or say that hit that chord, that made that wound?
I believe, Steve, you know, the wound was more so when I talked to my ex-boyfriend. I told you guys, I wanted to wait till I got married. And obviously that wasn't an issue with my boyfriend. You know, I was still going to go to heaven if I was with him, you know, even though we weren't married. And, you know, just seeing a lot of the negativity that, I mean, I saw a lot of guys doing a lot of stuff. Obviously, I hung out with a lot of guys. I was friends with a lot of guys, but it was okay for them to do certain things and not pay respect to the women or, you know, just, and I never judged people. I was never looking, but it was just like, when that happened to me, it was like, all this stuff people are doing. And, you know, I'm the bad person for it. So, I think that's why the wound was so big, because, you know, I had expressed my faith so much and I had allowed my friends and my family and people in my circle to be who they were, you know? And so once I felt like, wow, I did something that was basically out of my realm or people didn't see it coming, it was just the end all. And so for me, I think that's why the wound was so big. Like, I think if I would have had a baby or if I would have dated a married man, or I could have done anything else and it wouldn't have been as bad as that. That was pretty challenging to deal with.
And how were those relationships today?
They're much better today. I will say they're much better today. And I believe they're much better today only because of the God in me, and that they saw that God, because my faith is so strong, that they're just, I think, like I tell people all the time, you don't have to preach someone to become a Christian. You don't have to be like, you know, put God on people or anything like that. Like, God is bigger than all of us. And so what he does in my life is just going to be seen by others in their own way. It's nothing I have to do So I think down the line, people saw that. And my dad, I think the breaking point is when my dad and I had a conversation, and you know, we really talked about it from a faith standpoint, and everything just kind of changed after that. So it's much better.
What do you hope a young girl that's in Roseburg today that wants to play basketball experiences differently than what you did?
Just to love themselves no matter what. Don't feed into the stereotypes, and just to get out of their own way. At the end of the day, and that's why I wrote my book, at the end of the day, I spoke a little bit about it in that book. It was a short read, but God created us, each of us, with a unique talent. And I believe some people feel like they don't have a talent or they don't have a gift, but everyone has a talent and a gift. So for that young girl or that young boy growing up, you know, figure out what your gift is, what your talent is, no matter how big or how small. But what you do with that talent or gift is your gift back to God. And, you know, he'll give you a platform to use it to the best of your ability.
Mm. Wow.
Final one. You talked about your family, but I, you know, for me, you know, my mom and dad are still alive, but my grandparents had a huge impact on me. And I could tell very much so that your grandmother had an impact on you. What would you want to hear from Grandma Dixon right now about the woman you are today?
From both my grandmothers, Jibo and Dixie, just that they're proud of me. Mm-hmm. That's it. My parents, I have great parents. And I am who I am today because of my parents and the sacrifices they made and the foundation they built for me. But my grandmothers were, they kind of raised me in a way because I was so different. And I think, I mean, grandmothers just love their grandkids differently. So we're special in their eyes no matter what. As opposed to mom and dad are mad at you for mistakes or how they think you should be. My grandmothers, you know, me chasing a basketball and not being in the kitchen cleaning, they still loved me and respected me for who I was. So I think that was instrumental. And for me, I would just love to hear them say they're proud of me. And I took advantage of a lot of opportunities that they didn't have. My grandmothers did barely finish high school. They worked hard all their lives up to 70 years old. They never flew on a plane. I regret not taking them on a plane, but they were scared to get on a plane. So that was hard. But so for me to have all these opportunities, I just would love to hear them say they're proud of me. And I'm sure they are.
I literally can talk to you for the next 5 hours because of you have so many nuggets. You have so much wisdom, but you also have so much experience and you've seen the world. Thank you so much. And thank you for your time. And actually, thank you for who you are.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Steve. Keep being you. You guys keep rocking it out.
She said something that stuck out to me. She talked about basketball, speaking across all languages, and basically being a conduit for so many different people. Yeah. What's your reaction to that? Do you feel basketball or any sport is the same?
Every sport.
Yeah.
Because when you're playing basketball, unlike when you fill out an application, either for job, school, whatever the case may be, you have to put so many things, race, age, address, blah, 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 right? Mm-hmm. All these things. And then in basketball, you just play,
right?
You could be the tallest, shortest, you know, not the fittest, whatever the case may be. But your race, age, none of that stuff matters. Nope. Sex, nope. It doesn't. It's can that female or male, tall or short, put the ball in the hoop. That's
what we were talking about, right?
That's like all it matters.
It's you may not know the scheme of basketball, but you know the object is that team has to outscore the other team.
Yes.
Put the ball in the basket.
Correct. Yeah. And but what really stood out to me the most is her talking about her trip overseas and just seeing and learning about herself. And then she said something that was really interesting that we've heard from a lot of athletes is she had no confidence going overseas, and she gained confidence in herself as a black female. Mm-hmm. They are paying her, they bought her a flight. Mm-hmm. They put her on an airplane. They flew her over. And yet she still has no confidence
in herself. Still feeling somewhat less than.
Yes. And I thought that was really cool. I loved the transparency. I thought mm-hmm. that was excellent. I also was intrigued about her different, how going to all these different countries, what has shaped and molded her to where, why she's probably going to be a head coach pretty soon in the WNBA. Absolutely. Because she has so much diversity. She has such a great history with people that she has the ability to connect, right? I can imagine based off she's written a book. Mm-hmm. She's done all these things.
Speaking engagements everywhere.
Right? She's the type of person, well, I call it a social butterfly, that you get jealous.
Yeah.
Like, she always can just, she seems like she can spark up a conversation with anybody.
Yep.
Right? And just be the life of the party no matter what. And I'm always jealous of those people because I don't have that confidence in me to be able to do that. I'm like, man, maybe, am I going to say something stupid? Yeah. You know?
The stepping outside yourself.
Yeah, stepping outside of yourself. She does that very well. We didn't get into it, but she has been... she's the assistant coach. However, she has been asked mm-hmm. to speak to the team at times yeah. in critical situations. Just very rarely is the assistant coach
the voice
of the team. So
with
I think
a lot of big personalities on yes, that team, Skylar and Brittany. So that says a lot about her.
It does. So it was a treat for us, right?
Oh, yeah.
It was definitely, it was a snickerdoodle right there, right? It was really a treat for us. So I enjoyed that. And her talking about her grandparents and talking about her humble beginnings, really, really cool. You are a unique person. You are well worth it. You are competent. And most of all, you're lovable. I'm Steve Smith Sr.
I'm Gerard Littlejohn.
And this is Cut to It. Cut to It with Steve Smith Sr., that is me, is a production of Cut to It LLC, Balto Creative Media, The Black Effect, and iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
From Cut to It, executive producer Steve Smith Sr., co-host Gerard Littlejohn, talent and booking manager Joe Fushi, social media team, Wesley Robinson and John Cho. From Balto Creative Media, Cut to It is produced by Brian Baltashevich and Meredith Carter, with production assistance by Alex Labreck, production manager Sarah Pollock, theme music by Alex Johnson, lyrics and vocals by Anthony Hamilton.
If you ain't heard about it, then we're about to let you know.
You know it's on.
It's on.